You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Today we're talking about streaming, and not just what to watch, but how we watch it. With its streaming platform Prime and its production company, Amazon has become a giant in the industry and a lot of other industries too. Over the last 25 years, Amazon has gone from online bookseller to offering web hosting services, security technology, artificial intelligence, and in the vision of its founder, Jeff Bezos, one day, space travel. He's serious. As the company has grown and made Bezos the richest man on the planet, it has created plenty of controversy. And since the coronavirus outbreak started, Amazon has come under criticism for not adequately safeguarding the health of their warehouse workers and announcing that it would cut back on hazard pay at the end of this month. I talk with James Jacoby, director and co-producer of the PBS Frontline documentary Amazon Empire, The Rise and Reign of Jeff Bezos, when it premiered back in February. The film looks at what has been gained and lost culturally by Amazon's existence. James and his co-producer Anya Borg conducted more than 50 interviews for the film, including some of the original members of the Amazon team from the 90s. And I wanted to know, who was difficult to get on camera?
I'd say the most difficult was this guy, Shel Kappen. And Shel was employee number one. He basically built the digital infrastructure for Amazon.com with Jeff Bezos in the famed garage of Bezos's Bellevue, a Seattle home. And Shel was understandably reluctant to talk. And for a long time, Anya and I would meet with him, Anya more so than I, and just kind of talked through his concerns. I think that he'd been watching the company grow with increasing concern. And but when kind of a co-founder type speaks up, that's a big deal. And he wanted to make sure it was in the right context and that he trusted us. So he was really difficult. That was one of the last interviews we did.
Oh, that's interesting. So you as a journalist, when someone is concerned or reticent, your radar goes up. You think, I have to have this person. What, after spending time with him, what do you get, that sense do you get? He's clearly proud of the company, but he also has regrets. What is it you think he regrets?
Well, I think that, Shel left the company about 20 years ago, so he hasn't been there for a long time. And I think in a very profound sense, you know, having birthed something that's become so enormous, mm-hmm. and as he puts it, kind of an unstoppable and scary force in our society, I think that he feels responsible to some degree. And I think that there are other people that have founded these major tech companies that are coming out these days and talking much more honestly about what it means to have unleashed such a tremendous force in our society. And Shel, I think Shel feels as though the company took a direction rather early on that was much more commercial than he'd hoped. Mm-hmm. Initially, he built the infrastructure of what would be the largest bookstore in the world. And that to him felt like a noble, idealistic calling.
Sure.
And I think the minute that the company became much more kind of commercially minded, and then of course, you know, compounding that almost ad infinitum, I think he's grown more concerned about what it was that he helped to build.
Did you have a sense when you started out what this film would be about? And how did that change over time? Because as you start to research and get into something, it can sometimes take you down a different path.
Yeah. The challenge of this one was just the sheer scope of it, right? I mean, Amazon, as you said in the intro, I mean, it's in everything from cloud computing to having it transformed commerce to Bezos's space plans. I mean, it's just everything. And it's sort of like, okay, PBS is giving us and Frontline's giving us 2 hours. That's a tremendous amount of time. But even to get into any detail or depth on any one of these things, how do we do that? So we just kind of took this tack early on of thinking of the whole thing chronologically and just mm-hmm. saying, okay, where did he come up with the idea and how did it develop and what decisions were made and how can we tell the consequences of those decisions along the way? So we kind of stuck to that. I'm kind of amazed about how much we actually got in there, mm-hmm. but there's still so much more to do.
How much of Amazon is Jeff Bezos?
I think Amazon is a complete reflection of Bezos. You go to Amazon headquarters or you speak to Amazonians, as they're called, and everyone can recite the leadership principles. There's like 14 leadership principles that Bezos laid out really early on. Customer obsession is one of them, and all these kind of almost mantras that people know by heart. In fact, I interviewed this woman, Jennifer Cast, who's a very early senior person at Amazon who's been at the company for a long time. She gives her children the leadership principles. She carries them in her purse. I mean, the Amazonian way, they're sort of the Amazon way, is a reflection of Jeff Bezos' entire ethos. And that really is what Amazon is. It's kind of a state of being for all these people, and a kind of disruptive mindset. And I mean, most profound to me was this idea of Bezos believing it's always day one. And by day one, in fact, their tall tower, that the main tower at Amazon headquarters, is called the day one tower. And it's his whole idea that you have to treat every day as if it's day one, because day two is stasis and death. And you rest on your laurels for a second, or your accomplishments, you're done. And so it's this day one philosophy that imbues everything that Amazon does.
It was interesting. Something you can do in a film that you can't necessarily do in a book or a podcast is we get to see Jeff Bezos. Mm-hmm. And I was really struck by his personal and physical evolution in relationship to the evolution of the company. He's super dorky in the beginning. Yeah. He's sort of doughy.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, his diet at that point in those early years were Pillsbury dough rolls. I mean, that was actually what he subsisted on.
And now he's very sleek. He's got the, you know, sort of Lex Luthor, Mr. Clean hair. Mm-hmm. He's got the mansions all around. I'm curious, as a filmmaker, was that purposeful? Was that, because I found it to be very affecting to watch him physically change.
Yeah.
I don't mean to be shallow, but it seemed to signal something.
Well, you bring up something really interesting, because, I mean, we grappled with that a lot, in part because we wouldn't draw attention to a female CEO's physical transformation, right? But here was a man who had markedly changed over the years. And so we didn't want to bring specific attention to it, but you just can't help. I mean, we had an incredible, our co-producer, Megan Robertson, basically created probably the most comprehensive archive of all Bezos material that exists. And we had this huge amount of material of seeing him through the years. And you just, I mean, if you got him in 1995 and then you've got him in 2001 and then you've got him in 2013, you know, you can't help but see the major physical transformation. And along with it comes this different kind of public persona. In the early years, it was kind of goofy and affable. And as he becomes much more of a player, there's more of a seriousness about him. His voice gets deeper in a way. Certainly his kind of this air of confidence, certainly. And then by the end of the film, I mean, he's full on Titan and kind of an unbowed man.
He started out as in a hedge fund, in business. How does the experience there at D.A. Shaw, how did it shape his approach to creating Amazon?
I think it's absolutely essential to understand the D.E. Shaw years for Bezos. He had been a few years out of Princeton. He already had been kind of a quant mind. He had studied computer science and engineering and lands at this hedge fund here in New York, which was a really revolutionary hedge fund. David Shaw was a computer scientist, and he kind of applied computer science to trading and algorithmic trading and all these kind of complicated data-driven ways of trading. And Bezos really learned to look at the world in that way, look at opportunities in using data and the ability of computers to crunch huge amounts of data in order to figure out trading opportunities at that point. And the origin story is fantastic, in that Shaw says to Bezos, you know, I want you to look into something that looks to be growing exponentially, which is the World Wide Web and web usage. And Bezos looks at it, and he's kind of famous for saying, you know, there's very few things in life that grow as quickly as anything in a petri dish. And what he realized is that web usage was growing at 2,300% a year, and realized, okay, this is an opportunity of a lifetime.
You interviewed James Marcus, who was a former Amazon editor, and along with this footage of younger Jeff Bezos, he describes him like this. This is a clip from the film.
This is the original sign that I made for Amazon.com, blue spray paint on white poster board.
Jeff wasn't a figure out of folklore at that point. He was not the wealthiest man in the world.
Here's my computer, Amazon.com, up on the screen. Hello, Jeff Bezos.
He was a small, nondescript, sandy-haired man sitting at a desk with quite a large and eruptive laugh. But he wasn't threatening. He was a normal guy to a sort of amazing extent.
HAL 9000 hat is very important. HAL and I share a birthday. We're both born on January 12th.
It belied, you know, an enormous Napoleonic ambition.
That's from the film Amazon Empire, The Rise and Reign of Jeff Bezos. Was he always ambitious?
Yes.
Even though he was sort of dorky with that, I watched that clip with the laugh at least five times.
Yeah, it's amazing. He still has the laugh. It's just, you see it less frequently. He's always been ambitious. And one of the people we interviewed was an early childhood friend of his, Joshua Weinstein. They've known each other since middle school. I mean, Jeff gave his valedictorian speech in Miami, at a high school in Miami, about his desire to go to space. I mean, he's had these ambitions, these space ambitions, since about 15 years old. He'd read a book by a guy named Gerard O'Neill. And those space colonies we show you in the first scene of the film is his unveiling of his lunar lander, his latest lunar lander, and about colonizing the moon. But he also wants to build these crazy space colonies. And this is an idea he's had since 15. And one could argue, and Jeff plays it kind of close to the vest, and that he's really built this empire, this business empire, in order to fund his space ideas.
It was interesting that initially Amazon didn't make a profit for years, but that was sort of part of the business strategy. How so?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Bezos, you have to situate yourself back in the 90s, and there was the dot-com bust when basically none of the new dot-com companies were making any money, but their stocks were through the roof. He survived that. He was one of the few, you know, companies standing after all that. What he did was really original, though, and he basically said to Wall Street investors, I'm going to reinvest every single dollar that we make. I'm not going to post profits. I'm not going to care about the vicissitudes of the market and Wall Street reactions. What I'm going to do is reinvest, and it's going to reward you down the line if you stick with me, because I'll get market share and I'll be able to put competitors kind of out of business, because competitors have to post profits and we won't have to. Stick with me and we'll reward you down the line. And obviously that's worked. I mean, if you invested in Amazon stock early on, and it's now, what, $2,000 a share, you've done pretty well for yourself.
My guest is James Jacoby, producer and director of Amazon Empire, The Rise and Reign of Jeff Bezos. The corporate culture is so interesting, and you really present this in a way that makes you think, because on one hand, they talk about the customer. Remember the customer. There's an empty chair that's left in meetings because that's where the customer would sit, and the customer obsession. Yet, it is just reaping and taking customer data and trying to figure out all kinds of ways to get customer data, not necessarily in the most transparent methods. How do the people who work at Amazon now, I mean, you talk to some of their corporate folks, you talk to some of their PR folks, one of whom I picked out right away, I was like, that guy works in the Obama administration.
Yes, exactly.
How do they juggle those two in their minds? Do they answer for that? Like, yes, we're for the customer, but man, we want to take from the customer.
Yeah, I think that customer obsession, I'd mentioned those leadership principles of Jeff Bezos. I mean, that is the mantra, is all about the customer. And a lot of the past year, as we've been reporting this, it's kind of asking everybody, all right, what does that really mean? Mm-hmm. You know, there's this amazing Twilight Zone episode called To Serve Man. And it was all about these aliens who came down from space. And there was the bottom line of the episode is that it's all about the fact that, oh, it looked like these people were, these aliens had come here to help mankind eat more. Well, it turns out they were fattening them up to eat them, right? And so there was an economist who actually kind of brought that episode up with us about his view of customer obsession, that in some ways, as James Marcus said, an early employee, that it's felt a bit unsavory that, you know, trying to study customer behavior with all this data, anticipate what people's likes and dislikes are, having all this data to predict them, that in some ways this verges on exploitation, because the company knows so much about us that in some ways we don't even know about ourselves. And as James Marcus put it, it's kind of like getting a cow into a milking stall and extracting as many pails of milk as possible on every visit. But at the same time, it has been an extraordinary force for customers. I mean, keeping prices low, giving infinite selection to people. We do live in a consumer society, and there's been a large net benefit for customers. But I think we all need to be aware of, you know, piercing the veil of what customer obsession really does mean.
And you go into how the Obama administration really... Amazon flourished under the Obama administration.
Yes.
What happened during the administration that allowed that to happen?
A lot of things. I mean, one, the Obama administration understandably wanted to take a hands-off, you know, approach to the big tech companies. Amazon was one of the few companies hiring in the Great Recession. Now, granted, they did so in a way that we talk about in the film. They may have exploited that as an opportunity to some degree to mistreat their workers or pay very little. But at the same time, in the Great Recession, huge job losses, they're hiring hundreds of thousands of people in places hard hit. So that was one jobs driver, that Obama inherits the Great Recession, and that was a pretty good thing. There's also the aspect of the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission in how they viewed the enforcement of our antitrust laws. It goes far beyond Obama. It goes back to the Reagan years, really, where the FTC and the enforcers were really looking at our antitrust laws as only pertaining to whether a company has enough power to hurt consumers and not necessarily hurt other businesses mm-hmm. as they try to hurt, you know, as they're... So raising prices is a no-no. You know, using your power to extract more from consumers is bad. So the same philosophy persisted in the Obama years. So they really took a pass on investigating any of the tech giants for any of their potentially anti-competitive behavior. But that remains to this day. I mean, you know, one of the interviews that didn't make it in the film was with the new head of competition for the FTC. And I just basically said, how many enforcement actions have there been against the major tech companies? And he said, well, it's a tough question to answer. And I said, well, is it more than zero? And he says, no, you know, it's they haven't taken action. And so we'll see what the FTC under the Trump administration does.
My guest is James Jacoby. We're talking about the film Amazon Empire, The Rise and Reign of Jeff Bezos. In the film, you get into Amazon being anti-union. You get into safety issues, workers who tell you it's unsafe practices. This two-day shipping is causing people to have all sorts of health issues, concerns. When you bring these things up to executives, there just seems to be a disconnect watching the film. Sitting in the room with the executives, did you get, you know, in terms of your journalistic radar, were they truly disconnected or are they just incredibly well media trained?
It's a hard one to answer. I think, one, they are incredibly well media trained. They're also incredibly competent, and they're also true believers in what they do and who they are. And so there isn't, you know, my personal opinion is you walk in that building and I think that people believe in the mission. They think they're making the world a better place. They also think that they're very data-driven. So if there are data points, for instance, that suggest something's bad, then they'll you know, feedback they consider as data. Oh, we'll incorporate that. We'll think that through. But you don't get a real sense of true self-reflection. And that's what I found most interesting in those interviews. And I tried to bring questions, you know, for instance, to the devices guy. I read him an Orwell quote because I was like, okay, I don't think anyone's read him an Orwell quote about, you know, being living in a world in which you're being listened to all the time. And I think those were the things where I tried to pierce their very strong self-confidence in what they're doing and their belief in the Amazon way. But yes, they're very bright, they're very competent, they're very well media trained. And I think they're doing everything right.
There is a very revealing exchange with Robert Frederick, a former senior manager at Amazon Web Services, about the Alexa. Let's take a listen.
When do you turn off your Alexa?
I turn off my Alexa when I know for a fact that the conversation that I'm going to have or or whenever I just want to have a private moment. I don't want certain conversations to be heard by humans, conversations that I know for a fact are not things that should be shared. Then I actually turn off those particular listening devices.
So Alexa's in your home. They've got the doorbells with the cameras. There's a Ring you can talk into. Why do they want to be in our brains?
they want to be in our lives. And I think, that, again, from their perspective, one, they're going to keep creating and believing in what they're doing as long as people are buying it. And when it comes to Alexa devices, they've sold 100 million of these things. Alexa's compatible with like 100,000 different devices.
Do you have one?
I do not, no.
Okay.
I do not. My brother does, and it's bizarre. But, because I have a little niece, and she speaks to the Alexa, and that becomes an unthinking habit. And I think one of the things that's really important to recognize is, as Amy Webb, a futurist, puts it in the film, is that Alexa really marks this moment, more than Siri, more than a lot of these other things, where Amazon becomes this corporation you're talking to all day long. And an Alexa in your car, Alexa in your house. And it becomes this seamless integration into your life that becomes this unthinking habit. And the amount of data that they get out of us is extraordinary. Not only to train Alexa to be better and smarter, but also just in terms of the intimacies of our lives. So Robert Frederick, who has an Alexa almost in every room of his house, he went on in that interview to talk about how he's told his kids, he has a few kids, go in the room when you want to have a private moment, you disable the microphone, because there's a chance that if the microphone's on, she'll wake up, she'll hear a conversation or an intimate moment, and then there's a chance that a human being could listen to that recording.
That was my conversation with James Jacoby, director and co-producer of the Frontline documentary Amazon Empire, The Rise and Reign of Jeff Bezos, which premiered on PBS back in February.